This whole marriage thing that we have going on is just subjecting you to worse and worse stuff.
Welcome to Super True Stories. We suffer through and report back on the worst and weirdest documentaries you can stream. I'm Dave Hunt.
And I'm Jamie Hunt. And I guarantee I'm only married to one man.
Ditto. I feel like we need to reaffirm our monogamous marriage.
I think we need to start over because I said I was only married to one man and you said ditto.
Oh.
Which now leads me to think that perhaps you are a bigamist.
Well, the same could be true for you because you said that you're married to only one man.
Oh my God, you figured it out.
This is how we found out.
Right?
Oh, well, it would be better to find out 30 seconds into a podcast than an hour into this documentary.
Or any number of minutes into this documentary.
Yeah, this wasn't great. We watched The Bigamist Bride, My Five Husbands on Amazon Prime, about a woman named Emily Horn, who has been married 5 times, but never gotten divorced.
She has committed bigotry. Bigotry?
It's like before trigonometry.
Right. Bigonometry. She has committed bigamy with 4 of her 5 husbands.
Yes. As of the time of this documentary, which was in 2009. I wanted to share 3 quick reviews with you. The Guardian said that it was one of those extraordinary, oh my God, did you see documentaries? The Daily Mail declared this a powerful, at times blackly humorous, documentary that leaves you guessing even as the credits roll. And perhaps the biggest liar of the bunch, the Daily Telegraph simply said, compelling.
Are we talking about the same documentary?
Hopefully you and I are. This was almost impossible to watch. I think it's the worst thing that you and I have watched for this podcast.
I agree. This one was the worst hour of my life. And you know, of course, we take notes, so it takes more than an hour. And of course, I watch these more than once. And so I'm going to be sending the bill for my time and the time of my therapist to the podcast.
You didn't just inflict it upon yourself.
I mean, I feel like we can just dive right into Emily's story.
That presupposes that there's a story to dive into. It's funny because, Jamie, before we recorded, you mentioned that it's been a few days since you watched this, so you were a little rusty on being able to really kind of guide us through the plot of this. I just finished watching it, and I'm going to have a difficult time guiding us through the plot of this.
I don't understand who made this. It feels like it was made by one of her ex-husbands.
It does. It seems like the narrator, who's also the director, has a grudge against her. Like, he's taking things very personally because he is not the neutral bystander. He is very much condemning of this woman.
Some people have problems telling the truth. This woman is one of them.
And so to kind of set this up, Emily is done with her 5th husband and is dating a new man.
Yes.
That's sort of where we start up with this tale.
Yes, she is dating Wayne, and we see that she is leaving somewhere. She's got a whole bunch of paparazzi hounding her, and then while they're chasing after her and asking her questions, she appears to have an epileptic seizure from the camera flashes, and I'm saying it that way because I'm not sure.
Yeah, we see so many lies from her throughout the documentary that you really don't believe a single word she says. But as the paparazzi were chasing her, I kept thinking, they have a lot slower news days in the UK than we do. This is their big tabloid sensation, a woman who was married 5 times.
Yeah, and it sounds like the reason that this documentary got made was because it was a big hit on all the tabloids and in all the news cycle.
Why?
Yeah, I don't know.
They have royals. Can't they be focused on the royals? I guess part of it is that bigamy just doesn't seem like the worst crime you can commit. Like, it's sort of entering into a false contract or whatever, but it's not like murder.
No.
This isn't like the Chandra Levy documentary or the Lacey Peterson documentary. This is like some bloke named Simon got scammed by this woman documentary.
The way that you describe this, it doesn't seem like it's that going to be that compelling.
I know, it's weird. The documentary describes her story as a giddy mix of sex and deception.
Giddy is not the right word.
No.
This is like, what if we found a way to make sex and deception really, really boring?
Right. Would you like to have tedious sex? Because that's what you're about to have.
Tedious sex and lukewarm deception.
Deception that doesn't really lead anyone to any actual harm.
No. It seems like these guys are not very happy with their lot in life, but I don't know if they would have been that happy even before Emily.
Just for starters, Wayne and Emily meet in the hospital after Wayne was drunk and cycled into a lamppost.
Yes.
So his life wasn't on a great trajectory before Emily.
His life was already wobbly. As she's leaving court, she's been given a suspended sentence for what we learn is her second time at a trial where she's in trouble for bigamy. Wayne's family seems to be sticking by Wayne and Emily, even though they don't exactly like her.
No. In the most awkward camera angle shot possible, we learn more about why they don't like her. The mother is facing the camera, and then the sister is sitting at a right angle to the mother, and she has to keep awkwardly turning her head to address the camera.
Yes.
It's as though somebody went to film school to get lunch at the film school cafeteria and did not attend any class whatsoever.
Yeah, you could just sit them next to each other on the couch.
Right. It was so weird.
Throughout this documentary, one of the things that keeps getting hammered on is that Emily has a strange relationship with the truth. Like, she lied to them about her father being dead, and then when they found out he wasn't dead, she was like, well, he's dead to me.
Right.
Then one of the guys that she was with says that he was told by her that her dad died in a car crash. You can't really believe anything that Emily says, and her father even says that much.
The way she talks about her deceptions is very, very crafted. Like, she's speaking lines that she's memorized from a play.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very stilted, and it's very dramatically said.
It's about as natural as if she had been played by William Shatner.
Yes, it's exactly like William Shatner. And I hope this is where you will insert a clip of William Shatner.
The potential for knowledge and advancement is equally great.
I think we could probably walk through the marriages. That's kind of what this does.
When we meet husband number two, Sean, I think that's when we get our insight into why these men bought into it. They are out of their league on the attractiveness scale by a pretty big margin.
Yeah, but one of them is a train ticket guard guy, and he has a sexy uniform. Women love a man in uniform, don't they?
Like a ticket taker uniform.
Yes. Husband one was Paul.
We don't meet Paul.
No, we don't meet Paul. She was married to him when she turned 18. He was a soldier. She was married to him less than a year, and then she went to university in Leeds, where she met Sean, who would become husband number two. The other thing that she does, the pattern that we see, is that when she meets these guys, she very quickly starts pressuring them that they should get married right away.
Yeah, and one of the ways she pressures them is by telling them she's pregnant within a 2 or 3 days of them having sex, and they fall for it.
Yeah, Sean gets married to her after she told him. Then she's like, well, we got married, but unfortunately the pregnancy wasn't meant to be.
This fictitious pregnancy. Is Sean the one that she made him propose to her?
Yes.
Sean isn't quite ready to get married because they've only been together, I get the sense, for like a couple of weeks.
Yes.
And so he shows up at a pub where she's supposed to be meeting him. And there on the bar is a box with a ring in it and a note that says, you know what to do. And then he turns around and there she is. And she's like, yes, I'll marry you. And then he puts the ring on her finger and they're engaged.
And very soon after that, they're married.
And very soon after that, she quote unquote loses the baby.
And very soon after that, she leaves.
Poor Sean.
Why do this marriage stop?
Right.
You could go hang out with these guys, date them, bang them, leave them. And there would be no problem if you didn't do this odd marriage step.
Well, and she's not doing anything with the marriage financially or anything. It's not like the marriage is even an important component of her deception. It's like she just wants to get married multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not leveraging that into now she's got their assets or anything.
Right.
It seems like almost all of these marriages break up like almost immediately.
Almost mid-honeymoon, it sometimes sounds like.
Right.
So she marries Sean, but then like soon after that, she gets a temporary job in Norway. And the narrator says that she took a lover in Norway. Then when that person dumped her, she went back to Sean. And they had a great Christmas. And we have to pause here because they don't do reenactments in this documentary. Instead, they do storyboards.
Right.
So you get these awkward drawings of them.
They have arrows to indicate action.
At Christmas, I don't know if you noticed this, but I paused the documentary and took a screenshot because they appear to be wearing like Jughead hats.
I did not notice that.
I don't understand what's happening.
I think that's a UK Christmas thing.
You think they wear Jughead hats?
Well, I'm sure they're not called Jughead hats, but I think that type of hat is how the UK people's elves dress.
Hold on, I'm sending this to you. You think that's a... Would you describe that as a Jughead hat?
Am I going to court to discuss this with you?
Yes, this is part of the bigotry.
I'm not committing bigotry.
I think that the hats are part of the act.
Okay. So by February, she's sick of Sean, as I am sick of this conversation.
So yes, she's sick of Sean and she disappears again.
I don't think she disappeared. I think he went and took a job and left the area because they both suck at being married.
Well, he says that she started disappearing again.
I see.
Like running off for days and stuff. And so he took a job where he had to be away all week. And she told him, if you take that job, it's over. And he took the job.
And then seems to be shocked it's over.
Yes. While Sean's away, she reconnects with her ex-boyfriend, Simon.
Simon's not her ex-boyfriend. Simon is Sean's friend. So Simon and Sean are friends. Then Emily and Simon become friends. And then after Sean leaves Emily, this feels like a soap opera, Emily sits Simon down and tells him that she's always had feelings for him.
Compelling. I swear the documentary referred to him as an ex-boyfriend, but maybe at the time he wasn't.
He's an ex-boyfriend now. She doesn't marry Simon.
God, this documentary sucks.
Right.
She says that her time with Simon was when she was her happiest.
I love Simon. I've loved him from the moment I first saw him. And I will love him to the day I die. Simon and I would have torn the world apart for each other. We did.
And then Simon says...
I mean, the various degrees of love. I did love her in my own way, but it wasn't... I wouldn't say it was an all-consuming love, no.
But Simon's a prat. He's like, oh, she took an interest in the things I was interested in. What a loser.
How dare she?
Like, oh, the horror. She's interested in my interests. They argue about poetry and they argue about intellectualism, but he lives in his parents' house.
He does, and she gets to move in there. The narrator asks her if Simon made big romantic gestures.
He made romantic gestures. I wouldn't call them big. Best gift he ever gave me was a sunrise.
I sprained my eyes rolling them so hard. She's weirdly intense about Simon. And Simon, he's awful. Just these two really deserve each other, honestly.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that like this is the one that she wants the most or seems to speak the most fondly of. And he's probably the one who's the least interested in her, which those two may be connected.
But again, lives with his parents.
So Emily tells Simon that her sister died of a drug overdose, and she said, don't tell anybody. And then the day of the funeral came, and Simon's mother noticed that she just stayed upstairs all day. And so Simon accused her of lying and talking about what a wicked, horrible thing that was to do. And that kind of started to spell the end for her brief affair with Simon.
She is not a very good liar. Because if you're going to lie about your sister dying and that the funeral is on Tuesday, you can't just stay in the house that you live in with your boyfriend and his parents.
No, how hard would it be to just go to a park or something?
Go to the mall, something.
The narrator and her have this exchange where the narrator says, "You told me once you had a sister who died. Is that true?" She shuts it down.
Oh, God.
She's like, "You know, this was a long time ago. I kind of spoke more metaphorically about people being dead to me and things like that." And then the narrator says,
"But you still do it because you told Barbara and Vicky that your father was dead."
"That's for a completely different reason."
There are myriad reasons to lie.
She also has a lot of reasons to cry. As the date for her sentencing gets closer, she talks about how she cries alone, or she cries in the rain.
I'm making the gag me face. This is just so phony.
They split up after they buy a house together.
Well, I mean, if there's one thing that Simon can say about this relationship, it's that he got out of his parents' house.
That's a big growing up step for Simon.
Good for you, Simon.
After she leaves Simon, she bumps into Sean. He's lost his job. He's going to have his house repossessed. And so she says, "Well, I can move in there with this other guy named Chris."
It's like a real Three's Company situation.
The narrator thankfully lays this out and says she was living in a house with her second husband, Sean, sharing a bed with her boyfriend, Chris, while still having an affair and claiming that she was pregnant with Simon's baby.
This is the plot of one of those 80s nighttime drama soap opera things. Dynasty or something. Knots Landing.
I feel like those are easier to follow, though.
We're a good, almost halfway through the documentary at this point. And so far, she only has two husbands. But that's about to change.
It is about to change because Emily wants to get married again. So she marries Chris. And Sean learns that the two of them are married by having them come home and seeing a ring on her finger.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't laugh. Oh, Sean.
Chris thinks that Sean is just a former boyfriend, not a former husband or quote-unquote husband.
Or current husband.
Do you think like Chris was like, "Dude, if you wanted her, I mean, you should have like done something about it."
Should have put a ring on it.
Right?
There are some hilarious illustrations at this point, with one window has Chris and Emily getting down, and the other window has Sean sitting on his bed crying. Why he didn't just say then and there, "Hey, Chris, we're already married."
Yeah, it kind of gets to your point about what is wrong with these guys.
Yes.
And Shelley, who is the sister of husband number 5, has some theories. She says that Emily is looking for guys who are vulnerable that she can manipulate, and then telling them that she's had a hard life and needs saving, and then they want to take care of her.
She certainly has a type. They basically are all interchangeable.
Speaking of interchangeable, Emily's in this living situation at Sean's house, married to Chris, when she gets a job offer in Ipswich. So she just gets on the train, doesn't even say goodbye to any of them, and meets James. Sexy train guard James in his train guard uniform.
So she meets him on the train, his sexy, sexy uniform, he is convinced, turns her on. He thinks she's hot. She stays the night at his house, and in a few days, they get married.
He says that he was happy because he thought she wanted to be with him. But then, in a very dismal documentary, my favorite part happens, where James talks about the nookie.
She seemed to be very, very open-minded about the whole issue of sex. She was always wanting to do different things, had different suggestions about what to do. She had no issues or problems with herself being naked in front of me.
The wild, crazy woman.
Right.
And his example is, she doesn't mind being naked in front of me.
And then the narrator alleges that she was a prostitute. And then we get a whole lot of wordplay that is akin to Bill Clinton in the 90s, talking about what the meaning of is.
James found out I was working as an escort. I was working as an escort and a glamour model in London.
But did he know you were working as a prostitute?
By definition, please change your words. Escort, there is a difference.
What's the difference?
For a start, an escort is paying for her time. What she chooses to do on her time is her own choice. She can say no.
Okay, did you, when you were working as an escort, did you have sex with men for money?
Of course I did. But I also walked away sometimes.
Then they start talking about how she was also working as a quote-unquote glamour model.
She says that James knew she was an escort because she told him that she was a glamour model.
Modeling is not the same.
No.
Glamour modeling is not the same as prostitution.
Sex for money. Sex for money in private.
Posing topless is not sex.
Glamour model also covers adult film work. Porn star. Better word.
That's really not the same either.
No, no. Glamour modeling is the cover of Maxim. Trying to redefine words to mean something different than what they actually mean.
And I don't know if you had the same trajectory, but I started out being mad at the narrator.
I did too.
And then I quickly pivoted into being mad at her.
That is my trajectory as well.
Well, James decides that he's going to try to piece things together, and he discovers that there's this second marriage. And when he confronts her with this, she says, well, actually, I'm not married to just one other person. I'm married to three other people.
She just owns it.
Yeah. James gathers evidence and takes his finding to the police and gets her convicted of bigamy and a 6-month sentence. Not that it stops her, though.
After she gets out of jail, she begins working in a massage parlor. She meets Ashley, who is at the massage parlor because his buddies get him a massage as a birthday gift. Again, she's like immediately quote-unquote pregnant.
Yeah, she was with this guy for about 2 months, and she had told him that she couldn't get pregnant, and then suddenly she was, so he marries her. He looks to be about 15 years old.
Yeah, this poor kid. But then she almost immediately tells him that she doesn't think the marriage is legal.
Yeah, they're on their honeymoon on the way to Scotland, and she says that it's real in my heart.
Right.
Probably not actually legal. So he decides to stick by her. Compelling.
It's giddy. I'm giddy.
We're told that, you know, she had served the sentence in 2002, but prison obviously wasn't a deterrent. And this time she doesn't get in trouble. She gets away with a slap on the wrist or whatever and no jail time or anything. And the narrator says,
should she have been punished? Well, her life seems so chaotic and dispiriting that she probably needs help rather than punishment. She says the only victim was the law, although Sean, Chris, James and Ashley might disagree. And as for the truth, well, it seems as though the truth will always be a casualty, where Emily is concerned.
So dramatic.
And Emily says that she did lots of things that were wrong, but she says, I went one mistake too far.
Right. You married 5 men.
Right.
Maybe James was the one that was the mistake, because that's where she got caught.
Oh, that could be. So she says she's paid a very high price, but it's over now. And we're told that Emily now lives in a flat on her own and has no plans to marry again.
Wait, so she moved out of Wayne's house?
I don't know.
I don't care. Did you learn anything?
What did we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
I don't fucking know either.
It was a struggle. The way that I learned things was less from the documentary and more from Google.
Oh, Google.
She's been married at least 2 more times because she got in trouble for posing as husband number 7 to try to get prescription drugs. I also learned that she has changed her name to Maxine Acostas, that's hyphenated, last name Quiberbaron.
What?
I also learned that maybe I need to pick the next documentary.
This was bad.
This is the first time that you've picked something that I feel like actually hurt me to watch.
Well, Psychic, A Gift of Grace was painful.
This was worse.
This was one I couldn't put to you before I clearly established my role on this podcast. Because I've had this in my queue for some time now. If I had brought this out maybe like 2 or 3 episodes into my run on this show, you might have said, you know what, I'm just going to give up this whole podcast thing.
So you're Dr. Forrester, but you hid that from me for like 8 episodes.
I've been hiding that from you for about 21 years. This whole marriage thing that we have going on is just subjecting you to worse and worse stuff.
Well, I would say that's not true, but the documentary does have me slightly paused and wondering now. What did you learn?
I learned that train keepers...
Is that the right term?
I think so.
Okay.
Train keepers Ticket takers, UPS men, garbage men, any uniform can get you a girl. But the girl it will get you may not be one you want. Joking aside, did James pull a lot of girls because of his train keeping outfit?
Well, there's a point when James is telling his story where we get another storyboard where he's talking about how he spots Emily because Emily is dressed in a very sexy way, which appears to be wearing a dress.
Right.
It would have made sense to me for James to think that there was something up with this woman if she had been wearing her bigotry cap.
The Jughead cap from earlier?
That's what the thing should be. You know, instead of the scarlet letter A, if you're a bigamist, you should have to wear the Jughead hat with a B on it.
Is bigamy a big crime?
I assume that part of why people cared about this story was the idea that it was so unusual. So it must not be a standard thing. I'm not that interested in random, this like soap opera detail kind of stuff about people's lives, I guess.
Yeah.
If they've done something truly interesting, that's one thing. But this, could they have told this story in a way where you and I would have actually found it compelling?
Maybe if you get Baby Yoda in the mix somehow. Yes, I would watch it every week.
So it needs a Western soundtrack and a Baby Yoda.
Baby Yoda is the only thing that could save this story. There's no story here. I think maybe if there had been some sort of victimry, and then she stole all their money, that she got their houses. But it was just like, she met the men, told them she was pregnant, got married, and then left them. And then met a man, told him she was pregnant, got married, and then left him.
You know what it reminds me of? This is like the weak sauce version of what's that show? It's a guy, this girl marries him, and then they pull a scam. She's got conspirators, and then...
Okay, so then yes, they could make this into a compelling fictional tale if they added in a crime syndicate. But I feel like we need to remember the name of the show.
It's like a single word, isn't it?
Somethingers?
Bigamers?
Bigotrometers? I'm Googling.
I don't even know how to Google for this.
Imposters!
Imposters, there we go.
So, okay, you asked the question, could this be told in a way that would actually make this a compelling story?
Yeah.
I think we could pitch this as a show called The Bigamist or The Bigotrometers and maybe make it interesting.
The Bigotrometers sound like some sort of like Doctor Who villain or something.
Why not throw in Doctor Who? People like Doctor Who. But at some point we have to work in Baby Yoda.
I think Disney is going to become expert at working Baby Yoda into everything.
I can't wait for our Baby Yoda overlords. I will never tire of Baby Yoda. I don't have anything else to do except for bleach my eyes and use the Men in Black flash to erase this from my memory.
Somebody thought this was compelling.
Are we sure that it wasn't this movie is ... compelling ...
Well, as we learned a couple weeks ago, I mean, if the high point of your holidays is Brussels sprouts and...
At least in this episode, the Brits are being judgy about themselves.
Yeah.
Speaking of being judgy, if you would like to judge us, hopefully as excellent, we would appreciate your review wherever you download this podcast. We would also appreciate it if you would send us a note or engage with us on Twitter at SuperTrueStory. Or on Facebook at Super True Stories.
Yes, and we should give a shout out and thank you to Tomb Dragomir. He's the creator of our theme song, Mexicana Massacre, off of his album Instrumental Psycho Synth. And if you're looking for other cool podcasts to check out, we highly recommend our friends at 6 Foot Plus.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, welcome to 2020. Doesn't it seem like it's off to a great start?
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Catch you next time.
Bye.
Should she have been punished? Well, her life seems so chaotic and dispiriting that she probably needs help rather than punishment. She says the only victim was the law, though Sean, Chris, James and Ashley might disagree. And as for the truth, well, it seems as though the truth will always be a casualty where Emily is concerned.